Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Out with the old and in with the new. The data doesn't seem to matter. A look at some of the highlights from 2019 and economics to watch next week. All this and much more on episode number 643 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to 2020. Another year is gone. Another great one to come with the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And as always, I am your host, Andrew Horowitz. Welcome aboard. Thanks for spending another year with us. Just incredible amount of records broken in 2019 from the aspect of downloads, listener questions, the incredible guests that we had throughout the year. Much more to come in 2020. I promise you that it's going to be a good year. It's going to be a great year. I mean, think about how far podcasts have come over the last decade. Back in 2004, 5, nobody knew what a podcast even was. Now, everybody has a podcast and everybody listens to podcasts. It's really been an incredible journey. And I want to thank you for making this all possible, making this show as popular as it is. Thanks for telling your friends. Thanks for sharing this with those of you who have shared it with other people. Now, I've been investing a long time. I think the better part of 30 years. And for the most part, you know, the more things change, the more things really stay the same over time. Something that we notice that, you know, nothing really changes from the big picture. Maybe there are some subtle differences like how you trade or what investments you look at, what areas of the markets may be something that are important. Things like getting paper statements to now just getting them electronically delivered, or even utilizing a broker versus now doing it all on your mobile device. I mean, it's been an incredible amount of change, but basically, the same process goes along. And there's analogs from previous times, and I think they continue to ring true. You know, take, for example, 2019. I think this really puts things in perspective because we know that we come off this huge drop in 2018 towards the end of the year where there's a big concern that, wow, we're going to have a really tough year in 2019. All the trade wars and political issues that are out there, as well as the concern about, well, earnings. And earnings slowing down consistently and really, you know, the warnings that we saw in 2019 was going to be a big problem. And then what do you know? Well, we saw a much different situation. Why? Well, there's a lot of factors that are at work within the markets, not just a singular look at one particular item. And a lot of things changed throughout the years. It was fast moving in 2019. One of the things that we had that was really interesting in the year was a tremendous separation between economics and markets. Those that have been looking at, well, economics all the time and saying that, well, you know, what we see that's happening in a country or in a region or in a sector, and we look at the economics behind it, not just the economics from unemployment and things of that nature, but just the underlying metrics that go along with a particular area. Well, we use those for insights, right? To where markets may go. And if you used only economics last year, if you're looking at, well, the slowdown over here and earnings tailing off, the fact that we have a variety of things that are headwinds, like maybe currency issues, you're not probably too happy with what happened in 2019 with your portfolio, because if you were strictly utilizing fundamentals only, it probably kept you out for the most part of any investments in 2019 that were some of the best returns for the year. I mean, think about that for a second, because if you really just kind of just said, okay, I'm not going to look at anything else, just focus solely on economics, you would have realized that the world was slowing down. The U.S. was definitely a better place to be, but slowing down as well from a manufacturing standpoint, factory orders, couldn't get inflation moving. The highlight of the year clearly was the employment situation, better than expected employment, low unemployment, some wage growth. But generally speaking, it would have led you to, you know, not going to really invest too incredibly deep into the markets. But again, we saw that markets really didn't care about that. But maybe you took your cues from the geographic and global indications. And you were looking at things like the tariffs and currencies. And these two pointed to a bit of an uneven potential for markets. It was kind of like, well, we saw that there was a problem with the tariffs that were really implicating areas like Europe to a degree. Definitely the Asian region was going to have a lot of problems. And that did flow through. Actually, that did ring true where we saw that the biggest problems were in China. Forget about Hong Kong for a second. But China definitely had a slowing economy, hit hard by the tariffs and the trade war. And their market underperformed. But not so terribly. And once again, you look at these, markets didn't care in 2019. As the currency of the U.S., the dollar moved up, maybe there should have been some pain in the precious metal area. And with tariffs, probably see a major consolidation in industrial sector. That's just an example. Should have been crushed. Not really true. Yes, the industrials performed worse than some other areas of the markets. And the dollar moving up? No. Gold had a great year. Silver had a good year. Precious metals overall, commodities, had a really good year. In fact, when I look, about 95% of the sectors and asset classes and even the country-specific markets throughout the year of 2019, they were up pretty nicely. So now, again, you're dealing with just fundamentals. You're dealing with economics, and you're like, oh, what'd I get wrong here? What's happening? I don't understand. The only analysis that really would have put you straight, put you on the right course during the year, I think would have been, well, charting, technical analysis. For example, looking at specific support and resistance and following trends, moving averages, and, you know, any other trending indicators would have been the place that you would have said, well, you know what? If I put all this other stuff aside, if I close the door, turn off the TV, turn off the radio, don't look at any of the reports, don't look at the earnings, don't look at anything. But just follow the charts. You'd pretty much be in a pretty good place at this point. Think about that. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to close off the rest of the world, the news, the headlines, you know. I mean, that would be hard. It's very difficult. Well, you could cut back a little bit, go on a news diet, which a lot of people have done, because the problem has been that the news has been, just all about politics lately. And a lot of people are really disgusted about that. What's happening is they're kind of turning away from that. But charting would have kept you pure. Now, I am a believer in quantitative analysis coupled with fundamental analysis and then rounded off with technical analysis. I think that's all important. I think looking at the economics is also very important to understand the big picture of what's happening on a global basis and down to the country level. And the reason why I think maybe fundamental analysis, it's possibly would have failed you. Or maybe you wouldn't have done so well as hoped for. Is that if you think about really what happened in 2019, it was a year of multiple expansions. So essentially, if you're looking at value and you're looking for stocks that were cheap or even growth at a reasonable price, as we call it GARP, G-A-R-P, you'd pretty much be underinvested as valuations had been out of whack for most of the year. And I thought we'd take a look back at where we were, where we are, and where we may be going in terms of PEs and forward PEs and PEG ratios. Because I think that's some important things to really look at when we consider where we are in the markets in terms of valuation and priciness, frothiness. And after the drop in 2018, moving right into the beginning of 2019, what did we see? We saw that the PEs on a forward basis for the S&P 500, we're going to stick to a broad measure of stocks right now. Every individual stock, of course, has their own measure, but let's just kind of take a vast, broad-based view of an index like the S&P 500 large cap that can give us some insights into what's happening and what has happened. So we started the year with that big drop, right? At the end of 2018 into Christmas, Fed steps in, talks about how they're going to, you know, stop this whole rate hiking regimen that they have. And what do we get? Well, we start to see a PE at that point, starting the beginning of the year, at about 13.5, which is a decent enough value when you compare to historical averages. As a matter of fact, it was at that point in the beginning of the year where it was about 13.5, it took the valuation of PE or the PE ratio back to levels and the lows that were seen in 2013. Now you fast forward through the end of this year, where we are right now, we're about 18.2. Now that's the highest since the end of 2017. So when we look at the beginning of the year, perhaps the fundamentals on a big broad base measure was showing there was some value in the markets. 13.5, not too bad comparing to historical averages and comparing to where things could be. Of course, they could drop a lot more if things really fall out of bed. We have recession, big problems if the Fed continues to raise rates, but that's not what happened. Fed came in hard and fast, and we're still working on a reduced tax that the corporations are paying that went into play about a year and a half before. So generally speaking, these numbers were pretty appetizing for risk versus reward setup right at the beginning of the year. But you know what? That happened very quickly because if you look at that, the rally of the first quarter, it was pretty much the first quarter of 2019, pushed the PE level back to levels we saw throughout 2015 and 2017, that kind of range in there, towards the top of the range, towards the top of historical averages. Now, from a historical standpoint, well, went from a valuation that looked relatively inexpensive or somewhat cheap. And in 3 months, we're back to rich. We'll call it rich valuations. And at the same time, we had expectations of an earnings deceleration that was going to happen. And if you combine both of those, there was some question as to, well, are we going to see that earnings will actually pick up a little bit, or are we going to see this deceleration continue for some time? And now we have PEs back at the upper ranges. Well, what's going to happen? Now, when we split this up a little bit, let's kind of look at a little bit deeper inside of the S&P 500, where we split the value side from the growth side. The latest read on the S&P 500 growth sector on a forward PE basis is now at 22. Values at 15. Meanwhile, we saw a lift on both, of course, throughout the year because everything was just moving higher. There was no exception. Growth was definitely in play. The technology shares led the universe within the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, and even the Dow for that matter. And now we get into a point that, wait a minute, that's interesting. Growth really picked up. This valuation spread since, I would say, the last 2 years that has been favoring growth is continuing, unabated. Showing that maybe we're starting to see some frothiness in the growth side of the equation. Now let's go a little bit deeper. Let's dig down. Let's look at the PE ratio of the S&P 500 and relate that to the growth rate moving forward. What that's called is the PEG ratio, the PE to growth. So the S&P now is trading at about 1.8 on a PE to growth basis. So said another way, the PEG ratio is 1.8. And when I look back on the charts and I look back to the 1990s, way back to 1995, this is the highest level of PEG ratio that I've ever seen. I mean, it's just the highest you've seen. Which I guess could lead us to believe that the valuations are hot. And again, possibly in frothy territory. So let's just kind of break this down a little bit just for a second to talk about, well, what is the PEG ratio and what's a number that's not frothy or undervalued or normal? There's no such thing as normal, by the way. Whatever it is right at the time, but we have to consider the outward look as well. So if a PEG is at one, just one, call it one, it's considered fair value. So a PEG ratio of one basically means that you're buying a stock at a growth rate that is expected to be 10% per year growth on their EPS or on their earnings. And the PE is then 10. So you divide it, 10 by 10 is one. So if a PEG ratio is one, its earnings and its PE ratio, its multiple, is aligned. So putting it in more basic terms, the same growth rate people are willing to pay at a 1 is now 1.8, 80% more than fair value according to the PEG ratio. And again, we're doing this on an index basis on the S&P 500. Many stocks within there may show better value, maybe a 1, maybe a below 1, which is a super value. On a PEG ratio basis, you got to kind of combine a few of these things. Now, according to a lot of analysts, the PEG ratio is a pretty good metric. I like using PEG ratio. You know, for long-term trades where trends will reverse a little bit, you can find things that are better valued, that are not being bid up so high where the stock price has pushed it to a level that its PEG ratio is out of whack. Where the price to earnings that people are willing to pay compared to its growth rate of the underlying stock is not sky high. So ideally, again, one is fairly valued. Under one is undervalued. Over one is highly valued. I would say that from an index standpoint, that's very reasonable. From an individual stock standpoint, you know, you may have times where stock is trading at two times because maybe there's some really crazy things that are built in there that are not, you know, playing out on the near term. And people are willing to pay a lot more for something that's coming way out in the future. Now, even though this is just one metric that we can use, I think it's pretty powerful. And I'm even going to allow for some excess to be built into that particular metrics due to the low rate environment that we're in currently. And I would say if we were to kind of allow this to be pushed a little bit, well, maybe we could push it to about 1.2. So people are willing to pay 20% more on the growth rate with expectations that it would build in possibly. So in other words, instead of a 10% growth rate, companies going to have to grow at 12% over the next number of years, the projected growth rate of earnings over time. But what we're seeing is quite the opposite, isn't it? We're seeing that earnings are actually expected to decelerate and flatten for some time. So this 1.8 number seems to be just ludicrous, just tremendously overvalued. even if we allow for a little bit excess due to some of the factors that we know right now, maybe the trade war going to be resolved. Maybe we're going to have another tax break. Maybe the tax benefits are really going to help out into the future, and the low rates on the Fed funds rates and the dovish nature of the Fed and central banks around the world, that would, you know, help us to say, okay, I'm willing to stretch this a little bit, but again, stretch it to 1.2, but not 1.8. 1.8, the highest I've seen since ever on the chart going back to 1995. Are things going to be that good moving forward that we could say, well, I'm willing to pay that much more, 80% more than fair value, or even if we push to 1.2, let's say 60% more than fair value on a PE to growth rate of a stock, of an index. And an index gives us even more ability to look at this in a realistic manner. Again, not stock by stock. We kind of took 500 stocks and put them together. So let's kind of go back to why we're discussing this. And the whole idea is, you know, fundamental analysis-based research is telling us that, well, something's not quite right. And more importantly, what do we do now? Right? I mean, that's a question. You know, what do we do now with this knowledge at hand? How are we going to play it? Because do we just buy into the fact that, well, you know what? It didn't matter in 2019. Only mattered when the Fed really was trying to punch rates through the ceiling and people freaked out. Liquidity was being drained from the markets, and that's all that mattered at that point. Even with all the headwinds of the trade war, geopolitical issues, slowdowns, earnings slowdowns, nothing seemed to matter in 2019. Why should it matter in 2020? Why should it matter in 2021? Remember something. When times are bad, most people get the idea that it's going to be bad forever. When times are good, most people get the idea that, well, it's going to be good forever. The earnings cycle is going to continue moving higher and higher no matter what happens. The economic cycle is pretty much broken that, you know what, we're at a peak at this point and going to continue on that for a very long time. The cycles don't matter, but I'm going to tell you, I've told this 1,000 times, I'm going to say it again. Everything cycles. The thing we need to remember is that this is a long game. I think that's the most important part of all this. And we're thinking about what to do now with the understanding of what we've seen in the past and what we know in terms of the fundamentals and where we are at this point, utilizing PEG ratio, utilizing valuation metrics, looking at the economics, is that this is a long game. Investing is a long game. It's a series of shorter time frames that build into longer time frames that give us an analysis of what's happening from a trend standpoint. I can't tell you how many times historically I have seen the type of action we saw in 2019, and it usually ends the same way because investors get caught up in the momentum, they get caught up in the trend, they discard the important fundamentals and economic warnings that we're seeing, and for some time, things look like, well, nothing's going to change. And then what happens is the people that were the last holdouts capitulate. They capitulate and they say, you know what? I can't fight this anymore. I've been holding on to my cash for so long. You know what? I am not going to get anywhere with this, even though I see all these different warning signs that I believe are true. I can't fight this anymore. So you get a capitulation in the markets and people either throw in or throw out, depending on what side of the market cycle we're on. And one of the things that you have to rely on in this kind of environment where fundamentals and data doesn't matter is charts. Charts alone. The three parts of analysis, quantitative analysis, fundamental analysis, and technical analysis. Quanta, funda, techna. That's what we use. We use screening processes. We use looking under the hood. We look at the price action of the charts. And right now, where you can't really rely on the fundamental data, I'm talking about broad brushing it here, and economics, you have to rely on something, right? So what's the next thing you do? You go to the charts. And this is a really good way to make trading and investment decisions that will keep you in the trend, even if some of these other core analysis techniques will essentially just fail you. But understand that everything cycles. But one of the things you could do with charts is understand where the cycles may start and where they may end. And this is why we've been leaning portfolios more towards value-oriented investing and probably going to lean them even harder this year. It's why we've kept a position, for example, in commodities, even though throughout 2018 and 2019, several different times, I went and looked at it and said, you know what? Maybe we need to reconsider the whole commodity inclusion inside of our allocations. We're not making any money on this. But when I look back in time and I look back at portfolios historically, realizing that at times that you'd least expect it, commodities save the day. They provide a great diversification point inside the portfolio. And you know, if you try to time this, when this is going to happen, it's probably not going to work so well for you. Now, around the edges, of course, you can move money into whether it's crude oil or precious metals or ags if you're a trader. But I'm talking about investing from a long-term standpoint and where you want to have a portfolio diversified in a way that provides you with a very significant amount of underlying risk management. Whereas you're not just totally vulnerable to, let's say, just the ups and downs of the markets that are just equity related, where you're going to be investing in a variety of different asset classes and sectors that work together harmoniously to provide you some risk tolerance. And you've heard me talk about my flower garden theory where you want, I'm not going to go through that again. If you've been listening for a while, if you haven't, go read The Disciplined Investor, The Disciplined Investor is on audiobook. It's my first book that I put out, Essential Strategies for Success. And you can get that over on Amazon or Audible, wherever you're going to go. But there's a part in there that talks about the whole flower garden and why you want to have diversity in a flower garden, much like you want to have it in your portfolio. Because everything cycles. Just like the seasons. Sometimes we have a hot spell that lasts a lot longer. Sometimes we have a cold spell that lasts a lot longer. But in the end, the season cycle. Just like what happens with the economic cycle and the investment cycles. So leaning towards value right now seems like a much better risk reward trade-off, and utilizing things like alternative assets, commodities inside the portfolio, which did very well last year, actually. So we're really happy that we didn't, you know, throw that out. But right now, what you have to do, I think, is kind of mind the gap. Watch for potholes, bumps, signs that maybe there's going to be a turn back to fundamentals. And if there is, which there will be eventually, then you know what? The charts will start giving you a clue to when that's starting to happen. Because eventually we've seen cycles where value outperforms growth, growth then outperforms value then outperforms growth, techs will lag, commodities will lead. You have to really keep a keen eye on all of the inputs to discern what's exactly happening. The inputs include your fundamental analysis, your economics, and your technical analysis. And one of the best ways, I think, that you can keep an eye on all this and at the same time not get too caught up in the day-to-day volatility, if you will, is to expand your time frame and conceptualizing the bigger picture while you're looking at that. So there's no better way to do that than stop looking at the 30-minute or the 5-minute or the tick-by-tick time frame on your charts and expand them to daily and weekly, maybe even monthly. And then take a step back and observe what's going on. And here's why. I think when you look at the second by second and tick by tick data that's coming across a chart, there's incredible amounts of potential volatility. You'd have volatility due to news headlines, for example, or reports that are coming out, analyst calls, or maybe even some tweet. We know how that goes. And these all show kind of this really big movement on a tick-by-tick basis, on a two-minute basis. These short time frames that you're looking at, you can see big moves up and down. But if you step back a bit and you extend those time frames, it has a way of smoothing all that out. And when things are a little bit more level and contained and where you could see things on a much more smooth basis, you, as the investor, can make a much better informed decision, right? Doesn't that make sense? Because trying to drink water out of an open fire hydrant is pretty tough. But if you step back and you grab the water as it slows down and kind of goes into slow motion, as is the case when you expand your time frame from a 2 minute, 3 minute, 5 minute to a weekly, daily, or even monthly, it kind of gives you a better perspective. I think these moves that create volatility that are spooky are really difficult for a lot of investors. I mean, for example, the current news and what's going on in the Middle East that we heard just at the end of last week is a great example of what I'm talking about. And the question is being asked, well, how long is it going to last? And initially, we got this big drop in the markets, in the pre-market, and it started climbing up. Finished the day lower. Markets were a bit flustered by the news, but we have to ask, I mean, is this something that's going to break the recent trend? I mean, is this the straw that broke the back of high multiples and PE expansion, or is it just a bump in the road? Is it just, you know, simply another one of those things that are momentarily concerning, but that will pass? And will become something that, well, you know, on a weekly time frame, can't even see it on a stock chart. So the charts can help you really understand a lot about this, especially in a time when data doesn't matter. And I think it's important to get much more comfortable with your charting techniques and analysis process, building that in. Now, some people say it's charting, it's hocus pocus and all. It's not, because I'll tell you why. Because we know that major institutions use charting. We know that things like the 50-day moving average and the 100-day and the 200-day moving average are really important. That's why you see when a stock starts coming into its 50-day moving average, oftentimes it's supported. Why? Because people have pricing buys in on that level exactly. And unless it fails, they're going to continue to add to that position on or above, or a little, you know, within that range of that 50-day moving average. Take a look at a chart, put a 50-day moving average on it, and find all the times that you saw a tap of the 50-day, or maybe the 200-day or the 100-day, and then tell me this is all hocus pocus. It's what the crowd is doing. So we might as well follow along with that, right? You might as well get comfortable with what's happening and why it's happening, and understanding that there is some logic to all of this. And that's why it's being used so often with major institutions. There's a lot of psychology that's behind it. But again, charting gives you a very compact view of price. And price is really important, especially in a time, as I said before, two or three times, the data doesn't matter. But at the same time, you have to understand that eventually it will, and you have to mind that gap and say, you know what? Hey, I need to step across this and start thinking about, you know, watching out for these potholes. And as they get a little bit greater and where there's drop-off points, something that I may need to be considering. And how do you see all that? Well, again, a visualization of price on a chart, it's probably one of the best ways to do it. So think about that. I do think that 2020, while there may be a lot of outside influences on what happens with markets, I think there'll be a bit of a reality setting in sometime. That now, this doesn't mean I'm necessarily bearish or bullish, because we do a combination of sectors through ETFs and mutual funds in some of the portfolios, and we do individual stocks in others. But here's the basic thing here, that I have seen this game plan time and time again. And I think we're in the euphoric side of the markets right now, where froth is there. And I do believe there needs to be corrective action to bring us back down to levels that are much more in line with longer term trends. Because you can't tell me that today is different than it was, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or even 50 years ago. The major difference is that stocks are rallying, yes, because we have a very low rate environment, high liquidity, and there really aren't many other ways or places to invest that look better right now than the U.S. At least that was the case throughout 2019. But if the U.S. starts to tilt over and our economic numbers start to slow, the continuation of earnings contraction and growth in the negative side of things continues for some time longer, or maybe some other outside shock to the system, maybe where the Fed is going to start taking out some of the liquidity from the markets that they pushed in, the $400+ billion in the last 3 or 4 months of 2019, maybe that will have an effect, or maybe not even taking out the liquidity, but not adding any further liquidity may pause some of the outsized rally where we had this massive expansion of multiples, thereby pushing our PEG ratio to 1.8. Seems to me that eventually the data matters. It's going to be short-circuited by a lot of things like taxes, maybe a better trade deal, maybe the NAFTA or the USMCA gets through, or did get through, but maybe that helps. Maybe regulations being torn down, but you know what? We have another situation where that all led to massive deficits, incredible amounts of debt issuance by companies and by the governments. And again, that's creating another negative headwind sometime in the future. So just keep an eye on it. Mind it. And utilize charts to find out where the trend is and where it may be going, so you're not blindsided at any given time. Understanding the backdrop of what the fundamentals are, the economics, put it all together and create that narrative for yourself of where it looks like we can be, what the risk return trade-off is, and how, in fact, you want to be positioned according to two things, the key things: your risk tolerance level, your sleep at night factor, and your time horizon. Both being really important in so much as if you have more risk out on the equity side or wherever you're invested, and the volatility strikes and you cannot handle it and you sell out of it, maybe at the wrong times, or if your risk tolerance is aligned properly, but your time horizon's out of whack, where you only have 5 years until you start needing to withdraw money from your accounts and you have a reasonable amount of risk tolerance, but yet you really should be bringing it back a little bit because your recovery time is muted. Different than somebody that has 25 years for recovery, someone only has 2 or 3 shouldn't be invested in the same level of volatility because the recovery time is much more difficult. With that said, let's take a look back at some key points of 2019. Why don't we? I want to kind of hit some of these. I thought it was really interesting, a little bit of a rewind of what was best and what was worst. Kind of an interesting list here. The best stocks of 2019 in the S&P 500, the top three, all chips. AMD up 150%, Lam Research up 120%, KLA Corp up 104%. In a year that the expectations were there's going to be a slowdown in technology spend, basically due to, or higher prices and margin squeezes due to the tariffs, trade wars, etc. Really interesting how we saw the semiconductors pull up so dramatically, one of the oftentimes the leading indicators that will pull up and talk about risk on type of activity. At the same time, if you look at some of these, they look like they've gone parabolic, and I wonder how much longer they have to last at these elevated levels. The worst stocks of 2019, A Biomed down 48%. There was a study that questioned the value of their Impella heart pump. Macy's down 40%, which because they continue to obviously have their big box and they suffer because they just can't get their act together. And of course, shopping trends have changed dramatically over the last number of years. And these are the Macy's is the epitome of the old way of doing business and the old way of shopping. Occidental Petroleum down 30%. That's due to the Anadarko merger and questions about the overpayment and how they're going to put this all together. Mylan Labs down 28%, still dealing with these EpiPen issues. The Gap down 27%. Basically, this is a disliked brand, I guess we could say. L Brands down 25%. Again, another brand that's falling behind. Now let's look at sectors. Take a look at the sectors out there. Best sector 2019, you know it. What is it? What? Yep, tech. Tech up 50% in 2019. The tech sector of the S&P 500 up 50%. Communication services up 32%. Financials up 32%. Actually, these are just the general sectors that broken down. Up 32% for the financials. Industrials up 29%. You remember we talked about the data economics. We have a we'll talk about this in a second, but ISM manufacturing number that looks really bad. Factory orders terrible. The whole manufacturing side of things doesn't look good. But meanwhile, the industrial is up 29%. Not the top, but definitely not the bottom. Real estate up 29% as rates have come down significantly. And consumer discretionary, interestingly enough, up 27%. That's with these major retailers just not doing well. The worst sectors of 2019, utilities, but with a caveat. The worst sectors were still up a major amount because there were no sectors that were down in 2019. So utilities up 24%, healthcare up 20%, and energy up 11.8%. Now, what about asset classes and a regional update? 2019, we saw that crude oil surged by 34%. Last year, a lot of that had to do with the Saudi Aramco IPO, I think, where we needed to keep oil prices high enough to make sure we got top dollar for that IPO that came out. The S&P was up 31%. The Dow Jones Real Estate Index up 28%. MSCI EAFE, that's Europe, Asia, and the Far East, up 22% for the year. Pretty good. Emerging markets up 21%. Gold came in with a great year, up 17%. Corporate bonds up 14.5%. Now, the high-grade corporate bonds, high-grade bonds with the Barclays Ag, so they're very high-grade, top-tier, up 8%. What's interesting is we saw that major chase for yield throughout the year. We've been seeing this for a number of years, but really last year was very significant as the Fed turned and decided to start decreasing rates over time. So the race was on to find yield, and they went to all sorts of areas regardless of rating, risk, or outlook. Again, back to the data, doesn't matter. So they saw a nice return also, up 8%. Cash came in at 2%. Now, what about the best countries, the best markets in the countries for 2019? You know what those are? Some of them will surprise you. Some of them won't. There's a couple here, the best and the worst. Russia was the number one market around the world with a, this developed, essentially not developed, but at least not the total frontier, up 39%. That's probably due to the fact that we saw oil rise so much, and Russia is very dependent on oil for their markets in terms of the companies that are involved there. Greece was up 37%. Don't even ask me why. No idea. Except for the fact that it was cycling to lows before that. So maybe there was a reason to think that maybe they were going to get out of their economic malaise. And I don't think so. But Greece was up 37%. Now, the worst countries for 2019. Well, we had Chile down 20%, continuing rioting and problems and government dissatisfaction. Poland down 11%. South Korea really, and Singapore to a degree, were also very hard hit when it comes to the whole trade war. What's really interesting is South Korea has a lot of chip makers. And with the chip companies up so much this year, the semiconductors, kind of interesting to see that South Korea was down 3.65% for 2018. Now, finally, I want to discuss one more area. I want to discuss economics. We'll talk about something we saw last week as well as the outlook for the coming week, because it's a big week coming with a couple of different reports out. And I really want to discuss the ISM manufacturing gauge, because the latest report came in at about 47.2, I think it was, which was below expectations of around 49. It's been in contraction for the last 6 months or so. And what this is, just to kind of bring you way back to what we talked about last year, this is a confirmation, an absolute 100%, no questions asked confirmation of the pull forward effect that we thought could start in 2019. What's really, I think, fascinating about this is it hasn't really rippled through the entire economy, though. While we're seeing the manufacturing component and factory orders and industrial production, all that that's related to factories, have a severe slowdown right now. Really, the other areas of the markets and the economics haven't really been hit so much, like as in the employment situation or the ISM services, as a good example. And one of the things that we saw was that new orders plunged in the most recent report, as probably should be expected at this point, because we saw the front loading of goods and goods ordered pre-tariffs. So what's going to probably happen is, as I see it, there's eventually going to be a need for a restocking and reshelving. And if the tariffs stay on, probability is that higher prices are going to be paid for goods. And that's going to either lift inflation and consumer prices, the output prices, or we're going to see companies not passing on some or all of the higher costs. And that's going to see end up being a margin compression. So depending on how this plays out, but we're going to probably see a need eventually, no matter what the economy does, for factory orders to start picking up a little bit as inventories start to come down. And what ends up happening there is, you know, you have a simple supply-demand mechanical process going on here, which is going to demand a higher prices to be paid for outputted products, because the input part of it is going to be at a higher price due to higher tariffs. And again, whether or not companies decide to pass on all or part, depending on how strong the consumer is and how much they can actually raise prices, is the main issue. Either way, there's a problem. If inflation starts to kick up because prices are going to be kicking up on finished goods, that may alert us to the idea that the Fed is not really going to be in a position to continue with low rates as we've seen it, pumping money into the markets, quantitative easing, all of that. If in fact we see that companies decide not to pass that on and inflation stays subdued, that's good. However, they are going to show a margin compression, that's going to hit earnings. It's going to be very interesting to watch over the next couple of quarters how this works. The ISM services business holding up well, as we said. More people working, that's good. Eating out, higher wages are helping. So we have this bifurcation inside of the manufacturing components and non-manufacturing components, which has been really fascinating to watch. It's also a change of the way people are doing things, much more experiential type of activities, eating, drinking, going out, vacationing, traveling, etc., versus buying materialistic goods, if you will, that are above and beyond for the sake of having these goods. I'm not talking about the staples, because we all need toilet paper and toothpaste and all of that. That's an ongoing process. I'm talking about the excessive levels of material products. Next week, we have some important reports that are coming out. We have factory orders, ADP employment change, the official employment report, where expectations are for 157,000 to be added to the payroll, and a 3.5% unemployment rate. I would expect that some of the part-time and temporary workers that were put on into the holiday season will start coming off slowly, and that will probably keep a lid on the employment situation going into 2020. Well, that's going to wrap it up to a point. Of course, visit thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Send in your questions to Ask Andrew right on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Little button says Ask Andrew. Click on that and then send me your question, your comment. Do me a favor. If you haven't done so already, and in fact, if you listen through iTunes, can you leave a review? I saw some reviews. They're coming in pretty strong. A couple of people didn't like what I have to say, but that's the way it goes. But yet, if you do me a favor, if you like what you hear, or if you want to provide a constructive comment of any sort, go over to iTunes and leave a review. If you haven't done it so far, if you've been listening for a while, I would really appreciate it. I'm going to take a look, or just send me an email through Ask Andrew on in your comments as well. Thank you for listening. We're going to see you again with a great guest coming up next week. We have some few guests that are aligned for the next few weeks that should be pretty interesting. Thank you so much. Have a happy new year. I'll see you again then. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.